July 26, 1845, Baffin Bay. It was late afternoon as Anderson and his crewmates lounged on the deck. The 25-year-old Nova Scotian was on his second whaling voyage. Outside of the thrilling hunt for their bounty, life was pretty boring. The men passed the long afternoons chatting, playing cards, and making scrimshaw as they sailed between Greenland and northern Canada. Suddenly, they heard the captain call out two ships on the horizon. They looked and saw two warships with British flags. The men stared in awe. This was strange, after all. There were few forts in the Hudson Bay, but they were to the west. These ships were sailing north. There was nothing there. Anderson and the crew knew that the only thing up that far north was the mythical Northwest Passage. As the ships neared, they could see the crew hustling around the deck and a proud officer standing at the helm of one of the ships. Regal and determination in his eyes, a few of the crewmen waved as they passed. One of Anderson's crewmates muttered, "Poor bastards," as they knew nothing but ice and frost lay that way. As the ships moved towards the horizon, and Anderson and his crew began back to their lounging around, the captain called Anderson up and requested for him to write in the logbook, "Sighted vessels, Erebus and Terror." These vessels, and the 134 men aboard, would never be seen again. Hello and welcome to Spooky You.
Hi. What was that about?
Well, that was about that for my episode, because, you know, I like to pick the scary history stories. Today, we are talking about the Franklin Expedition.
And I know nothing about this, so I'm coming in blind, and I just got a phenomenal prelude to this episode, just like you guys. As we start every episode, we are Spooky You. I am one of your hosts, Allie.
I am the other host and MC today, JP.
MC JP, what up?
Everyone ready to hit the floor? Because you're about to be frozen to death and are eaten.
Eaten?
Don't worry about it.
I was about to say, yeah, we're going into seasonal depressive disorder. What is it? Sad.
Seasonal depression?
Yeah, what's the middle word?
Seasonal
affective disorder.
Oh, I already went through that. I'm now at the other end of the spectrum.
Okay, well, yeah, but the people in your story are about to go through it. So we're about to really get into it, aren't we?
Yeah, we're going to get into it, guys. I am sorry, but this is not going to be a pleasant fun. It's going to be very informative, and it's going to be a ride, but this is, hey, you signed up for the spookiness, and I know most of you guys live for this.
Hey, I am excited, JP. I've never heard the story. I don't even know what the Franklin Expedition is, because I did not pay attention in history class, and I've been out of high school over 10 years. So teach me something new, buddy. Let's see what we got going on here.
Well, without further ado, let's get in to the story of the Franklin Expedition.
Dun, dun, dun. That's the last time, I swear. I won't do that again.
You do know I can add effects.
Yeah, but, you know.
Since the discovery of the New World, nations have been fascinated with the idea of finding a new trade route with Asia, circumnavigating the overland Silk Road, which has been now taken over by the Ottoman Empire. Since sailing all the way around the bottom of South America wasn't viable, practical, or even safe by the period standards, going all the way around Africa was a long time, they've been fascinated with the idea of a Northwest Passage, going over North America and right into the Pacific. Since 1497, countless explorers have searched for such a passage. Most notable names include Sir Francis Drake, Henry Hudson, James Cook, and countless others over the centuries. All efforts ended in failure, and most were lucky to just come back at all.
I do have to say, in theory, the Northwest Passage makes sense.
It does, yes. If you don't know what the north of Canada looks like, it does make sense.
And they did not know.
By the 19th century, the combined efforts of explorers and the Hudson Bay Company had concluded that no Northwest Passage existed in temperate waters. The only remaining route was through the unforgiving Arctic. However, these efforts helped immensely by mapping out much of the areas of Canada, and by 1804, less than 200,000 square kilometers remained unmapped, with only a 500 kilometer area left unexplored for a potential passage on the eastern side of Canada. One thing I want to note about the time is that sailors were under the impression put forward by Danes Barrington's theory of an open polar sea. The idea was that waves would prevent ice from forming in open water outside the Canadian archipelago. Basically, if ships could get far enough away from the islands, they would find open water.
Again, in theory, it makes sense.
It does logically, but science rarely ever works by human logic.
Yeah, I'd say that tracks.
In 1804, Sir John Burrough became second Lord of the Admiralty at the age of 82. He had long dreamed of seeing this last corner of the map filled in, and the timing couldn't be better. In 1815, with the end of the Napoleonic Wars, the British Navy had changed missions from military to peacekeeping and exploration. In addition, improvements in sailing and navigation technology further improved the odds of success. This was Burrough's best chance to see the passage forged, and he was placed in charge of building such an expedition. And who better to lead it than Sir John Franklin? His fifth option.
Oh, his fifth option! His fifth! Fifth runner-up. Okay, so, JP, in my non-historian mind, can I tell you how I'm equating these two people?
Sure.
Okay, so you remember the movie Atlantis? The Disney movie, the animated one.
Yes.
You know the old guy that funds the whole trip?
Yes.
That's Burrough?
More exotic than Sir John Burrough, but essentially, yes.
Okay, and then Milo Thatch is Franklin. Maybe not the first choice, although in the movie, Milo Thatch was his first choice. But that's how I'm equating these two. For those of us that are not historians.
Position-wise, yes. Personality, competency, ability. No, they're completely different.
Okay, but position-wise, you said yes, so I'm going to call that a victory, all right?
Whatever helps you, Allie.
That helps me, because that's a great movie.
It is. It's very underrated in Disney films.
It is underrated. Also, sidebar for 1 second, did you know Lilo and Stitch is 20 years old?
No, because why would I want to think about that?
We're already going to get depressed in this episode, so I thought I'd just add that in. All right, keep going. Please, tell me more stories.
So John Franklin was the fifth option for, well, four other reasons. The first two who were offered the position to lead the expedition turned it down because they were so close to retirement, they didn't really want any part of a dangerous expedition to the Arctic. The third had next to no relevant experience, but he had connections with Sir John Burrough, so his name was tossed in, but the rest of the Admiralty turned him down. The fourth was highly experienced, had several expeditions to the Antarctic and Arctic, and this was Captain Francis Crozier, who was turned down because he was of, quote, too humble origins to be the face of the discovery.
And what do you mean by too humble
origins?
He
was Irish.
Are you fucking kidding me?
Remember, Ireland was like the first colony of England.
Yeah, I remember.
Glad my history's rubbing off on you.
Yeah. No, I just watched Dairy Girls.
So that left Sir John Franklin. Though fifth, he was still highly qualified. Born April 16th, 1786, Franklin joined the Royal Navy at the age of 14. He was an accomplished captain and served in numerous conflicts, including the French Revolution, Napoleonic Wars, and the War of 1812. He also took part in several surveying expeditions and two Arctic explorations, one of which for the Northwest Passage. The most famous being the 1819 copper mine disaster.
The copper mine disaster?
Yes, Allie. Located in Kukutuk, Franklin led an overland expedition to map this remote area just south of Victoria Island. However, due to poor planning and bad luck, the expedition turned into a disaster and Franklin lost 11 of the 22 men under his command.
That's 50%. For those of us that don't do math, that's 50%. Sorry.
Very good.
Very good. You're getting your master's degree. You know percentages. Very good.
Your company will be so proud.
I hope no one listens to this. I hate myself.
Despite receiving a hero's welcome from the public, Franklin was received with a little bit of shame and mockery from the Admiralty and was often referred to as the man who ate his own shoes.
I'm sorry. How does one earn that nickname and don't say the obvious? Are you kidding me?
That does happen a lot in survival stories. You'll hear people start to eat the leather of their shoes.
Is it like beef jerky?
Well, remember, this was back when it would have been genuine leather from cowhide.
Oh, like not the processed.
Not today. Have. Yeah, not today where it's plastics and nylon.
Oh, God.
Not thinking about that, this may have been a partial motivator for him taking up the job. One last great accomplishment before retirement. Of course, this is the Northwest Passage. The glory alone at the time would have been the equivalent of landing on the moon.
Okay, that's high praise. So he's in this for the glory and the shoe jerky.
Hopefully not the shoe jerky. I think he wants to avoid the shoe jerky.
Well, you'll tell us if he consumes the shoe jerky, correct?
Yes.
Oh, spoiler alert. Maybe not. I don't know. I don't know what's coming. Keep going.
I will say one fault of Franklin was that while he was beloved by his men and commanded a lot of respect, he was also kind of aloof at times and not the most sure of himself when making decisions.
Aren't we all?
Our next section, plan for the worst. With the captain selected, the Franklin expedition set about creating the team and supplies for the most well-equipped expedition in history. Since this was an expedition for the Northwest Passage, the latest in charts and navigation equipment was used for the job. This was also going to be a research expedition, so equipment for collecting samples and specimens and identifying species were also included, along with a naturalist who would accompany the voyage. Starting from the top, these ships that were slated to be used, Erebus and Terror, were retired bomb-class vessels designed to withstand mortars being fired from their decks. These ships were further outfitted for the expedition by adding extra planking and iron at the bow and waterline to withstand the pressure from ice. And if you've ever been on a ship in an ice pack or an ice, it is terrifying. You hear it banging off the walls. It's crunching. It feels like at any second, it's going to crush the vessel like a soda can.
And you know this from experience?
Not from experience, but you can honestly just watch a few episodes of Deadliest Catch and you can kind of see where the faces of the crew, that this is not something they enjoy.
Okay. All right. Well, you learn something new every day, especially on this podcast.
The ships were also fitted with stoves to provide heating and steam engines whenever the wind wasn't enough. They even had an insulating diving suit to conduct repairs. Most importantly for the crew, a recent development of canning allowed fresh food to be sealed and prepared for months, even years after being prepped. This means that the crew would have access to the vital vitamins that they would need to ward off disease, especially scurvy.
So what you're saying is that this vessel and this crew were essentially overprepared. They had everything they needed, in theory.
Yes, the two ships. One ship named Erebus, the other named Terror. Yes, they were outfitted as best as possible because they wanted this to be the final push. This was expected to be the last voyage for it.
These are the ships that are going to figure this out. We're going to fix things. We're going to find that passage with these boats. That was their thought process.
Exactly. And they even stocked up on enough supplies with enough canned provisions to last 3 years.
3 years? Wow. Okay, so they were really prepared.
Also remember, they did expect that they would have to spend a few winters in the ice. So they knew that what they were getting into. But the idea was that they would get through and then be able to make contact with ports in Russia, America, now Alaska, and then be able to resupply there before going on to Asia.
Okay, so the thought was there.
The thought was there.
The thought was there.
And they truly tried to think of everything, including having a full stocked out library and other costumes and amenities for performances and leisure activities for the crew.
Okay, that's good. That's really good.
Of course, this is on this podcast because everything would be destined to go horribly wrong.
Yeah, okay, that tracks for us. All right, well, regale the story.
Setting sail. In May 1845, the Franklin Expedition set sail from England, stopping in Greenland to take on additional supplies. 5 men were left in Greenland for medical reasons. Then, the expedition continued up north into the unknown. During their stop in Greenland...
I really want to speak Frozen 2 right now, I'm sorry.
God damn it, Allie, I was on a roll there. During a stop in Greenland, letters were sent home from the crew. They described that they were in high spirits and confident in the mission. A few days later, a whaling ship spotted the expedition at the mouth of Baffin Bay. This was the last sighting of Erebus and Terror, and from this point on, all information of the expedition is based off of archaeological evidence, recovered journals, and native interviews. 1845 to 1846. In early September, the expedition circumnavigated Cornwallis Island and anchored off Beachy Island. As the pack ice moved in, the expedition set up camp for their first winter. For many of the men, this would have been their first time in this alien world. Long days of summer glistening off the ice crystals creating halos in the sun, and the winters brought the mysterious display of the Aurora Borealis. Despite the beauty, there were many hidden dangers as well. Aside from the extreme cold, the crew of the expedition would have likely emotionally and psychologically struggled in the long, dark, and cramped environment of the ships. This likely would have caused depression and bits of agitation. But the crew was also under very strict discipline, being all in the British Navy. Interesting thing to note here is that even among the ship, there were very segregated areas. So certain crewmen, depending on their job and their rank, could only be in certain parts of the ship. We'll get into this a little bit later, but there's a really good scene in the miniseries about this where they use crew members talking about a dog and how the dog walks around to determine what the rank of the dog is. So it's an interesting way to kind of quickly introduce the culture, but understand that's kind of what we're dealing with right now in these ships. So right now, we're stuck in the ice. And we're going to flash forward to Beachy Island, 1986. It's a clear day as the research team from the University of Alberta begins to exhume the grave of John Hartnell, a member of the Erebus crew who perished in January 1846. Among the team is Brian Spensy, Hartnell's great-great-nephew. Due to the Arctic climate, the bodies were well preserved. And sure enough, as a team opened the coffin to reveal the corpse of John Hartnell, who, despite 140 years, looked like he only died weeks ago. This allowed the team to perform an autopsy and even grab DNA and tissue samples from the body, hoping to possibly glimpse at what caused his demise. As the team gathers in the meeting tent to hear the results, the doctor reports that John Hartnell was suffering from tuberculosis. This would explain why the 5 sailors were removed in Greenland. Brian Spensy, now knowing what killed his family, looked out at the other graves on the island, wondering if his great-great-uncle was actually one of the lucky ones.
So, that's first of all, that's huge for science, the fact that they were able to do an autopsy of those people because they just happened to be buried where they were buried. Second, was he one of the lucky ones?
Well, we're going to find out, Allie.
Uh-oh.
Yes.
Spoiler alert.
He was the second luckiest.
We an ASMR podcast now?
No, I'm just whispering because I don't want people to get the spoilers.
Oh, okay. Well,
also, I hope everyone enjoyed that photo that Allie posted of the actual corpse of John Hartnell on our Instagram page.
JP, I'm not doing that.
I willed it into existence, Allie. Do it.
JP, I'm not. First of all, Instagram will kick us off, okay? That's definitely violating guidelines right there.
Are you kidding? I'm pretty sure the BBC did it.
Okay, the BBC is not a podcast Instagram. The BBC has lawyers and funds, and they can do these things. I'm not, Wait, what was the guy's name again? I'm going to look up the picture while we're talking here.
John Hartnell. Just look up Erebus and Terror Corpse.
Will do.
April 1846. After a long winter trapped in the ice, the Franklin expedition was underway, leaving behind...
Ah! What the hell?
JP, why? Why? Why would you?
Why not?
I'm not posting that on our Instagram, JP.
Oh, come on. Okay, everybody just look it up. I'm keeping that. I know I said it was going to be dark. I'm keeping that in the episode. That was too good.
Oh, my God. I can't unsee that. Why would you do that? Why? JP, no. Nobody go look this up. It's very foul. It's very.
Do it. No. Do it. It's really fascinating.
I mean, yes, it's fascinating, but don't look it up.
I thought you said you like spooky things.
Oh my God, I'm crying.
God, that was so good.
JP, I thought I was on mute.
That was hilarious.
Oh, I'm so sorry to anybody.
Oh, no, that was good. That was, oh my God. I was like, what the hell? Oh yeah, that's right. I forgot. I told her to look up the photo.
No, I'm not posting that on our Instagram.
I'm just glad you looked it on your phone and not on your computer. God, that would have been...
Also, I did scream so loud that I scared Flurry and he started barking.
Oh, that's funny.
Okay, I'm sorry. Keep going.
April 1846. After a long winter trapped in the ice, the Franklin expedition was underway, leaving behind the bodies of John Torrington, William Brain, who died on April 3rd, giving us a rough timeline of how long they were there, and John Hartnell. Despite breaking free of the ice, it still would have been slow going for the crew. They likely would have had to struggle with navigation and having the magnetic north constantly changing on them.
Oh, like the compass in Stranger Things.
Yes, so for context, compasses obviously work by pointing towards magnetic north. Now, magnetic north is constantly moving and really doesn't ever line up with true north. While being further south, you don't really recognize that declination too much. Being that close up in the Arctic, it forces it all over the place, making navigation extremely difficult, if not impossible. And the navigators likely would have struggled severely in the summer without the aid of celestial navigation. Even today, it is hard to navigate the Arctic without GPS.
Wow, I actually did not know that. It's really fascinating.
Right? A little bit of science, a little bit of comedy, mostly all dark.
Dark comedy.
The crew would have likely been in high spirits after weathering the dark cold winter on Beachy Island. Spring rolled into summer, it would have gone from all darkness to complete light with the sun circling them as they traveled. It is possible that there may have been a few tense situations as individuals would have come in to the doctor reporting either a certain level of fatigue or soreness. But they were sailors at the edge, so this wouldn't have necessarily raised many alarms initially. Despite this, the crew was slowly being poisoned.
Wait, what?
We're going to jump forward again. 1986.
JP, you can't just drop a bomb like that and then jump forward. You're not a Netflix show.
Too late. I did.
Okay.
Hey, Allie, why don't you go and look up that lead poisoning thing?
Fuck you, JP. Fuck you. Fuck you, JP. What was it again?
Franklin Expedition corpses.
I'm not looking up that again. Did you say there was something with lead poisoning you wanted me to look up?
No, I'm kidding. I'm just kidding.
Oh, okay. Don't look up the bodies, guys. It's not, it's gross.
Look them up.
I don't like it. What?
I said look them up.
No. I mean, it's kind of fascinating. Okay, keep going.
1986. As the body of John Hartnell had more to tell than just his time of death, due to the Arctic's ability to preserve remains, the autopsy gave more than just his tuberculosis. One surprising revelation was that Hartnell had extremely high levels of lead in his system, even for the time. One likely culprit, the research team believed, was the soldering on the crew's canned provisions. At the time, canning was a relatively new process. However, the cans provided to the expedition were made by the lowest bidder. This meant much of the food would have been spoiled, and perhaps at some point, the expedition's sick bay would have started filling up with people complaining of the symptoms of lead poisoning. The ship's officers and surgeons would have likely begun to investigate, maybe using some animals aboard to check supplies. This was also another problem. With the cans being spoiled, this would have also meant much of the citrus that they had brought on to help with the vitamin C would have lost its ability, and thus, scurvy would become a factor. For those of you who may have only heard of it, scurvy is an ailment that comes from a lack of vitamin C. Since most vitamin C sources come from food that spoils, sailors during this time were at great risk. Early signs include weakness, fatigue, and being up in the Arctic, this likely would not have gone noticed by much of the crew. This would be followed by sore gums, loss of teeth, loss of hair, and changes in mood and behavior. Added with the stress in the environment, would have only compounded their struggles.
So they were set up for failure at this point. With the food spoiling, the cans, the lead, everything. It was just like one thing after another, but it was caught too late.
It was caught too late, and we don't know for sure if they ever figured out what was going on with their canned provisions.
Okay, okay.
It's suspected it's possible if the doctor or surgeon on board had begun to notice the effects and realized that they weren't just from scurvy.
So, theoretically, they kept eating and poisoned themselves more.
This is explored a little bit in the miniseries. It's a mix of if they didn't know, they would have just kept eating. And if they did know, they wouldn't really have had any other food source, as food is very scarce in the Arctic. And with little to no of the crew having any experience hunting there, they wouldn't have had another source of food.
Okay, I'm following you. Yeah, you're right. You're right. That makes sense.
September 1846. John Franklin had an interesting choice before him. As the expedition sailed south towards King William Land, his fellow officers discussed their options. They could sail east or west of King William Land. Most would have proposed to sail west, as the exact shape of King William Land was unknown. Some may have speculated that it was actually King William Island and proposed to sail east and around. This would have eliminated the fear of being trapped in the pack ice that would have moved south between King William Land and some of the surrounding islands. But Franklin, not wanting to get bogged down, and likely seeing that they were close to the end, chose to sail west, figuring it was they would make it out and maybe at worst suffer one winter in the Arctic again. What they didn't know was that King William Island, in the western side of it, was actually extremely dangerous. Every year it becomes filled with pack ice blown down by the prevailing winds. As the crew attempted to pass the island on September 12th, they became stuck. The men sawed, hacked, and blasted their way, but to no avail. With winter closing in, they faced another winter trapped in the ice. 1847. The expedition would have been through two-thirds of their supplies, but likely still choosing to stay on the ships, believing they would break free in the spring of 1848. At some point, several of the men would have found a cairn left behind by a previous expedition. They placed a note stating, "All well." However, as winter rolled into summer, the ice refused to release the ships. On June 11th, Captain John Franklin passed away. It's not exactly clear what caused his demise, but only that it was written in a letter much later on. In addition, 24 men had also perished. Again, no explanation as to what caused their demise. Possibly leading to the fact that they may not have figured it out, or possibly tuberculosis had taken some of the men. Again, there's nothing to confirm.
And realistically, in the Arctic, it could have been some other things too. You know, they could have gotten sick. with something else. They could have gotten frostbite. There's a couple of things that definitely could have happened. So yeah, I'm sure that they're not 100% sure exactly what caused it.
Even if they were, they didn't write it down. By this point, command would have fallen to Captain Crozier, and it was clear that the expedition was going to run out of food before they made it out of the ice. With no other choice, the remaining men, the 105 crew who were able or willing, left Erebus and Terror in a desperate attempt to make a nearly 250-mile journey to Back River, and then sail additional miles south to the nearest Hudson trading post.
So they're going on foot at this point.
And dragging the lifeboats with them, filled with all their supplies.
Oh my gosh.
Mind you, at this point, many of the men would have started to become malnourished and would have further began to just wither and break away as they went south.
Oh, this is horrible. JP, this is horrible.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. That's why I had to add in that little joke where I asked you to look it up.
I hate that you did that.
I know. This information would later be discovered by individuals in a rescue effort in 1850. By the time many of the sailors would have started to become malnourished and begun suffering from scurvy, reports that I will cover later claim the expedition was breaking into smaller factions. Some speculate it may have been based on health. No accounts talk about the organization or stability of the group have ever been recovered. Regardless, every one of those men would only find their way to an icy grave.
Okay. Do we know how the remainder went?
We do. And we're going to get into it in a sec because the expedition was not the only people in the area.
Oh, who else was there just hanging out in the ice?
The native population.
Hell yeah, they were. That's awesome. Good for
them. You know, the ones who actually live there.
Yeah, who know how to handle the terrain and who, you know, respect the land and everything.
Yeah. 1854. John Ray trudged through the snow. He'd been in the Arctic for several years, mapping the area for the Hudson Bay Company. About a year after mapping out the area of King William Land, or as he had discovered, King William Island.
Well, at least someone discovered it.
Well, I mean, the Franklin crew likely did, but they didn't live to tell the tale.
Touché.
He made contact with the Nisilik Inuit. John had been curious to talk to these people. Earlier in his expedition, he had met an Inuit who attempted to trade a blue hat with gold trim. He claimed it was from a group of white men. John was aware of the lost expedition. No one knew what had become of them. When he reached Repulse Bay and met the Nisilik, he was surprised to find they had buttons and other pieces of Royal Navy uniforms. Without a doubt, these belonged to the Franklin expedition. Excited by the discovery, John began inquiring what they knew about the expedition. It turns out the Nisilik had actually encountered the expedition as they made their way south in 1848. Alive and, well, alive.
I was going to say, yeah, alive and doing fine.
Not even fine. They were not okay.
Nah, yeah, you're right. Alive and not okay.
They explained that a hunting party from the village had found the expedition. They tried to help the men, who they described as tattered and in a pitiful state, and were dragging large boats, crying out in agony. The boats would have been filled with people who were suffering or at such a severe state of scurvy that basically it causes extreme pain and feeling of brittleness. So being dried across the rocky shores would have basically been agony for them.
Oh my god, this is horrible. JP, this is horrible.
The hunters tried to help the men gather food and supplies, but resources are scarce in the Arctic and they couldn't sustain such a large group of about 40 men. A few weeks later, they went to check on the survivors' progress. Nisilik found what appeared to be an abandoned camp. Upon further inspection, however, they found a haunting sight. The remains of the few survivors of the Franklin expedition, huddled in tents, or simply collapse in the snow. They explain to John the trail of toothless bodies that follow north.
I hate this image. I hate this image.
Those who simply collapsed on the trek. Most horrifying were the cooking pots. In their most desperate hour, the men of the expedition resorted to cannibalism.
JP!
Are you serious?
Deadly serious.
That wasn't funny.
No, that was not, but...
That was... JP, that wasn't funny.
You are suppressing a smile.
I am, but that wasn't funny. Are you... Really? Oh my god. JP, Okay. I was not expecting it to take that turn.
Desperate starving men in the Arctic with nothing else to eat?
Touché. Holy crap. All right.
John Ray, shocked at the revelation, recounted everything he heard back to London. Despite being literal eyewitnesses to the account in the final days of the Franklin expedition, Lord Admiralty denied everything that the Netsilik had reported outright.
Why the hell did he deny it?
I'm going to get into that in a second. Even by 1847, Lady Franklin, wife of Sir John Franklin, was worried about the fate of the expedition. She lobbied on numerous occasions to send rescue, but the Admiralty dismissed her, claiming they had the utmost confidence in the expedition. Plus, it would take a while for them to hear word if the Franklin expedition made it through.
That's true.
By 1847, with no word from the expedition, Captain Clark Ross was sent after the expedition. It would not be until 1859 when subsequent expeditions and rescue efforts would find the remains on Beachy Island and the stone pile on the northern coast of King William Island. The accounts of the Netsilik were dismissed back in England because Lady Franklin, and with, amazingly, some help from Charles Dickens of all people.
Like Christmas Carol Charles Dickens?
Yes, like Christmas Carol Charles Dickens, wrote several short stories claiming only the lowest of man could resort to such barbarism, and the idea of the heroes of Britain could commit such a horrible, unthinkable act could have only been proposed by those of savage nature from the edge of the world. Yeah, so Charles Dickens basically dissed a bunch of Netsilik people.
Well, he's a dick.
He is a dick, yes.
He is a dick.
Keep that in mind when you read Great Expectations. Charles Dickens trash-talked and belittled a native people.
Oh, shocker. A white man from the 1800s belittled people and treated them like garbage. Shocker.
Weirdly enough, I actually don't know what Charles Dickens' reputation is these days, but I'm glad I was able to just fire a cannon at it.
For like the 20 people that listen to us.
Yes. In 1993, archaeologists followed the direction of Netsilik oral history and found the remains of the campsite. Evidence from the skeletal remains that were recovered found clean knife marks in the arms and legs, confirming the story of cannibalism.
Oh, foul. Absolutely foul.
1848. A lone sailor sits huddled in a makeshift tent, vision blurry, with every movement agony. Any strength he once had was gone. It already took so much of him to even need his comrades. Suddenly, he began to giggle. Giggling turned to laughter, and laughter turned to howling. He saw visions of his friends when they were acting out the plays of Romeo and Juliet so long ago, when they first began stuck in the ice, when they were together and they felt invincible on top of the world, ready to make history. Since then, he saw one leader, Franklin, Crozier, Blakey, each succumbing to the elements. Now, he was all that remained. But he couldn't think about that now. He needed to rest. This is likely the fate of the last member of the expedition.
JP, I know it's, we're recording this in June. I know it's cancer season because I'm emotional and I'm holding back tears right now. Why would you do that?
Why would I do that to you?
Why would you do that?
I don't know.
You just love to watch the world burn, don't you, you little asshole?
I do, yes. I do love to watch the world burn.
So is that the story?
That is the story. And now we'll discuss the legacy of the Franklin Expedition.
Can we first just, holy crap. Holy crap. Like, oh my God, I feel so bad for the men on that voyage. You know, they had high hopes going into this. They were so excited. You know, they were explorers, and then, yeah.
Yeah, it's one of those, I know a lot of people, and especially up here in Alaska, there's a lot of thoughts and opinions about colonialism and the encroachment and kind of the general exploration. That, though, that's a pretty rough fate to wish upon anybody.
Yeah, agreed. Yes, I think we both have the same ideas and thoughts about colonialism, but that, you know, you would never wish that fate upon somebody.
Especially in the Arctic, that far north, it is a struggle to survive up there. And if you don't know what you're doing, man, that is oof.
Yeah.
And there's even some things I didn't get into, like, they had, obviously, polar bears live up there. There's botulism type E that would have been in the meat. So even if they did come across seals and managed to hunt a little bit, if they didn't know how to cook it properly, that could have killed them too. They really just were, they were really getting punched in from every direction.
Well, tell me a little bit more about the legacy. How did their story live on?
The story of the Franklin Expedition in British culture has become one of hubris. The most advanced and well-equipped Arctic expedition ever to set sail, ending in tragic disaster. In hindsight, it has allowed us to see flaws that led to the expedition's demise. Everything from the selection of the ships, to the improper canning, the struggle of navigation, and the unusually cold winters that sealed the fate of Erebus and Terror. But one interesting thing I really want to talk about is how we have been able to find out so much about that expedition. And that is because of the help of the Nisilic oral tradition. Not knowing anything about British culture, many grew up fascinated by the stories of strange men who came in massive ships and slowly met their end in the tundra. In fact, it was through the tireless research of Nisilic historian Kemukak that led to the discovery of the ships Erebus and Terror in 2014. Amazingly, they were found in Terror Bay, named after the ship.
Oh, not a coincidence?
Yeah, named after the ship, the Terror, and then they were like, oh, what are the odds? The ship's actually here.
It's in Canada.
Yes.
I'm going to see where it is.
Okay. Many books have been written about the expedition, and most recently, the AMC miniseries, The Terror, based off of the 2007 Dan Simmons novel, have been one of the more detailed accounts of what possibly took place during the expedition. And honestly, I highly recommend it. I actually binged watched the miniseries before we recorded this. It is just as dark and depressing as I have described it.
Yeah, that's why I'm going to wait to watch it till after I'm done grad school. Because right now I'm rewatching Schitt's Creek because I want to be happy. And this did not make me happy.
Yeah, this is not going to make you feel good, but it is good. I think one of the lead actors was in Chernobyl.
I wanted to watch that too.
He's in it. They do a great job. I will say the book and the miniseries are, I would say, more of a inspired by history. They do a good job of grounding a lot of the real world threats that the crew would have faced and their likely demise. Up to a point, then they added a whole other factor into it that is just straight up horror monster movie.
So, okay, so I located the bay. I have to say, they were close to a potential passage.
Oh, yeah. It's actually thought that perhaps they may have realized that they found the Northwest Passage as they went, and subsequent expeditions to find Franklin's expedition did finally forge the passage.
Yeah, like they were close. They were really close. But I'm trying to figure out where the nearest city is.
Allie, can you look up Toonbach for me? Just do it.
On the map or on the internet?
On Google, on the internet. Could you please look up the Toonbach? T-U-U-N-B-A-Q.
T-U-U-N. Why? JP, why? JP, why? Is it a human?
No.
What is it?
It's from the miniseries, The Terror.
Why would
remember
they
how I said they had a they kind of went into like straight myth monster like monster movie?
First of all, why would they add that in? Because, you know, what actually happened is just as scary. Second of all, why?
I don't know. I think it just a little bit of horror series. It's not. Yeah, I know. I watched the series out. I know what it looks like.
Why?
And it's actually pretty scary in that.
I don't like you.
I know. I know. You've made that plainly clear throughout our entire history.
Yeah.
In the show, the Toonbach is completely original for the series and book. It's possibly has roots from actual mythology, but everything about it's original for the series. And I likely think it got added because, I don't know, one, watching 105 men slowly starve and have disease-riddled deaths wasn't exciting enough. And two, the show needed to nerf about 30 or 40 people at a time to kind of get the countdown.
Okay, yeah, that was probably Hollywood, but still.
Though I will say a little bit of credit here. I don't want to speak too much on it, but the times where they portray the Nasilic in the show, they did try to stay pretty true to how the culture was and is, including hiring Nasilic actors to play many of the characters.
Okay, good. I'm glad they did that. I'm glad they at least held as true as they were able to, or at least I hope they did.
There were some bits that they did say they either added in for a little bit of drama or they brought in from different cultures to add in. But again, the Terror miniseries and book aren't an actual historical base, more of a horror story based off of the expedition that do a very good job of painting a picture of what it may have looked like for the expedition.
Okay. Would you consider this like a good read and a good watch? Like, would you recommend it to somebody?
I would recommend it as a good watch. I have not read the book. The series is really good. I will say just obviously be prepared. It's not basically just a very long horror movie.
Okay. I mean, we all watched Stranger Things season 4 by now, so like we're probably used to that.
Yeah, and it's kind of, it's pretty interesting too as you're going through. I hate to say it, but yes, the things surrounding the Toonbach and the Nasilic, it does lead to an interesting mystery because it's one of those not fully explained, but you're just kind of like, what is this? What's going on? Why is it here? Why are people doing what they're doing? It's just a fun ride.
I'll have to try it out. I'll have to watch it.
But anyway, that is Erebus and Terror, the Franklin Expedition. Yay!
Sorry for screaming in your ears.
Yeah, let's come out of the darkness now, everyone.
Come out of the darkness into the light. Go take a walk and enjoy the sunshine if you're listening to this at night. Why? But if you can't fall asleep because, you know, JP's story was a little too scary for you, you can always go follow us on Instagram at SpookyYouPodcast.
Where you can see the Toonbach and the corpse photo.
No, you're not going to see one of those things.
We'll send the link.
No.
What?
You could also email us to get that link at SpookyYouPodcast@gmail.com.
Email me your comments directly.
And just say, JP, you're the worst for making us look up that body, because that's horrible. Why would you do that?
Or the Toonbach.
The Toonbach was just like, it's unnecessary. It's like a human bear hybrid. I'll post that one. That one I don't mind posting.
Okay.
But the body, I'm not posting the body. That's wrong.
Fair enough.
Yeah, that's... Google Images can have that one. I do have a line somewhere. That's my line. posting a dead body. Yeah. But anyway, go give us 5 stars on Spotify and listen to how funny we are, because you should tell your friends about it, because we're cool. Okay.
Enjoy, everybody, and have fun. Class dismissed. July 26, 1846. Wait, was that 1846? God damn it.
Can you put this like at the end of the episode?
Yeah.
This is really funny.